Psalm 139. O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise, you perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. You hem me in, behind and before. You have laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful, I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God! How vast is the sum of them! Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. If only you would slay the wicked, O God! Away from me, you bloodthirsty men. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me. And lead me in the way everlasting. For many of you, one of the highlights of your study here is the subject which you do in first year called Intro to Degree Theology. In my day, it was Doctrine 1. That was the equivalent course, which was at Moore College, which was taken by the principal of the college, David Broughton Knox. And my notes of that course still are precious to me. I read this in my notes. The doctrine of God is of the utmost importance, for it controls the whole of life. As a person thinks about God, so his standards of behaviour, values and relations with others are determined. Spurgeon says, there is something exceedingly improving to the mind in a contemplation of the divine. It is so vast that all our thoughts are lost in its immensity, so deep that our pride is drowned in its infinity. Now, the word we most commonly use, which characterises God, is the Latin word omnis, all. That God is omniscient, all-knowing. He is omnipresent, everywhere. He is omnipotent, all-powerful. And those three terms really provide an excellent structure for us of Psalm 139. Look, for example, at the first six verses. Here is an excellent description in verses 1 to 6 of God's omniscience, God's perfect knowledge. Now, you can be impressed by knowledge. This year I went to the test at the Sydney Cricket Ground, the cricket test, Australia and South Africa. And on the day I went, Richie Beno was there giving a speech about the Australian fast bowler Fred Spofforth, whose brass statue was being unveiled at the Sydney Cricket Ground. And just standing there and listening to Richie Beno, you couldn't help but be impressed by the wealth and the breadth of his knowledge in the cricket world. And my wife and I were watchers of Gardening Australia. And the past presenter and host of Gardening Australia is a man by the name of Peter Cundall from Hobart in Tasmania. And you cannot be impressed when you listen to him about his enthusiasm for organic gardening. See, human knowledge is very impressive, but human knowledge has two major limitations. And the first is in its subject matter. All of us are ignorant, we're just ignorant in different areas. So I don't know how much Richie Beno knows about organic gardening, and I don't know how much Peter Cundall knows about cricket. But they are experts in their own field only. So human knowledge is limited by its subject matter, and of course it's limited by its time span. We know something of the future, but we don't really know in intimate detail things which haven't yet happened. Now notice, God's knowledge here we see has no such limitation. Look at verse 1. He says, O Lord Yahweh, the personal covenant-keeping God, he knows me well because he has searched me. Verses 2 and 4. He knows me beyond the externals to thoughts. Even before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. And so here is David, and with us we probably feel that sometimes no one understands me. No one knows how I feel, but Yahweh does. He knows me beyond and in all the routine events of life. Look at verse 2. When I sit down, when I get up. Verse 3. When I'm going out and when I'm lying down, when I'm in public and when I'm in private. Verse 5 tells me that he goes before me. He's the vanguard and he is the rear guard as well. He comes behind me. Verse 3 says, you are familiar with all my ways. The idea of familiarity there is winnowing. You throw the grain in the air and the grain falls to the ground. As the wind blows through the grain falls and the husks blow away. It's exactly the same word for familiar. You have winnowed me. There is no superficiality here. You sift through. You know my actions. You know my motivations. You know my thoughts, and it's all too much for me. Verse 6, it's lofty. You are the God to whom all hearts are open, all desires known, and from whom no secrets are hidden. He knew Cain when he killed Abel in secret. He was there and knew when Achan was stashing away the loot in secret. He knew David's heart. He wasn't impressed by the externals. He knew what Nicodemus needed. He knew how many husbands the Samaritan woman had had. He knew he needed no one's testimony about man, for he knows what is in us. And we say, if you only knew how awful I am. He does. He knows how awful I am. He knows the worst about you, but he loves you just the same. If only someone understood, he does. He understands our frame. He knows that we are dust. Jesus knows our every weakness. Yet can we find a friend so faithful who will all our sorrows share? He knows. He understands. There is nothing I'm experiencing that he doesn't know about. But there's something vulnerable. There's something exposing in being known by it like this. I don't feel easy about being known so well. I do want some secret compartments in my life, some areas that are off limits to everybody. And that leads him into the second omni in verses 7 to 12. He says, I want to get away. But it's a sort of desire to get away because he feels so exposed. He feels so unfit to be known so deeply and intimately. It's sort of like a child wanting to get away from the parent. I want to get away because I don't want to be discovered like this. And yet I don't want to run away from my loving parent. And so he explores all the options that are open to him. Look at verse 8. He goes to the vertical extremities, up into the heavens, down into the depths. He goes to the horizontal extremities, over to the east where the sun rises and over to the west where it sets. And he says, no matter where I go, if I go with Jonah down into the bowels of the ship or into the belly of the whale, even there I find you. Our first parish, as you know, was in a place called Weewar, and we had a little branch church 50 miles out of Weewar, about 80 kilometres out of Weewar, through the Pilliga scrub, a place called Wabigar, G-W-A-B-E-G-A-R. And it was basically made up of people who, during the war, many of the people who lived in town, in order to escape the draft, escape the war, just got on the train at Central Railway Station and went to the end of the line. And the end of the line was Wabigar. And they got off, and that's where they settled for the war years, and they stayed on afterwards. You go to the end of the line. But there's no escape. Even if you go to the end of the line, and if you've been to Wabigay, it feels like the end of the line. But God's there. Verse 11, you go to the dark alleys of the night spots. I'll hide myself away there. I'll get into the cinema where I'm quite alone. I'll get to the back corner of the pub. I'll bury my head in my computer screen. There is no covering which hides you from Yahweh. And so he says in verse 10, I don't run away from him, but I run to him, and I find that he has, without me knowing it, guided me and held me. Even there, he says, your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. In other words, there is no circumstance that has ever come to me that he has not faithfully been there to guide me and to hold me fast. I was never alone. That's what David Livingstone said, wasn't it, in Africa? What was it that sustained you in those difficult times in Africa? The word of a faithful gentleman who said that he would never leave me and never forsake me, and God never will. And the psalmist finds that. He doesn't want to be known this well. He looks at the possibilities of escape, but then he realises how foolish. Even there, your hand will guide me and your right hand will hold me fast. He is the omnipresent God. He is the omnipotent God as well. So even there in the dark spots, well, let's look at that most hidden of places. That place that we have no memory of. Look in verse 13 to 18. He is the God who is all-powerful, omnipotent. He is the God who made me. And he emphasises that in verse 13, where he says literally, you yourself. It was definitely you. It was not my parents, not my mother and my father. It was ultimately you yourself. This is how you know me so well, because you put me together. You are my creator. What a remarkable insight here. That before we have any developed knowledge of life in the womb, look at what he says. Verse 13, you created my inmost being. You knit me together. Same word is used of the people embroidering the curtains for the tabernacle. All that fine needlework. You knit me. You embroidered me together. You were active there, verse 15, when I was woven together in the secret place in the depths of the earth. You were there. Intricate work. Now, some of you will know that this year, since December, I've been battling with a knee. I jumped off a rock ledge just before we went on holidays, and I did something awful to my knee. I don't know what it was. But anyway, I've been going along to the physio, and I went along to the specialist, and the specialist told me what I need to do, and then I went back to the physio. And the physio down here at Burwood, who's a good bloke, he was explaining to me how the knee works. And he said, quote, your mate did a good job on the knee. Meaning God made a good thing when he made your knee. We can't really replace it as well as he did. Your mate did a good job on the knee. Too right he did. It's an excellent hinge. It's a terrific joint, the old knee joint. Verse 14, I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. And look what he says in verse 16, your eyes saw me in that embryonic state. And even there, your sovereign power was putting me together. But even there, your sovereign care extended there to oversee all my days, that after my birth, you decreed all my days. Every one of them. You know them all. You are the God who knows, who is present, who cares, who watches me. And you know every day ordained for me to live. Verse 17, how precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast were I to count them. They would outnumber the grains of sand on Bondi Beach. Not Bondi Beach, the grains of sand on the planet. This is an incredible, incredible thing. Early this year, Maxine and I went to the IQ debate series, as you know, and we heard the first debate on the proposal that we should legalise euthanasia. And at the end of the debate, a man got up. There was a public question or comment time, and took the microphone, and he basically said this, because they were arguing that we should legalise euthanasia with strict controls. He said, I was around when we legalised abortion in Australia, and I thought it was a fair enough thing. People argued for abortion with strict controls, and I thought, well, in Australia we'll probably have 500 to 1,000 abortions a year. And that's fair enough, because I can see the need for that. But do you know that last year in Australia, 250,000 children were born, and 90 to 100,000 were aborted? Where are the strict controls? 250,000 born, 90 to 100,000 aborted. Now think of that. That's filling the Melbourne cricket ground with aborted children. That is overflowing the Sydney Olympic Stadium. And yet these days, even if you want to debate that issue, you're seen to be a radical. Now notice what King David is saying here. The moment of our beginning is not the moment of birth. The moment of our beginning is not the moment in which the embryo becomes independently viable and can live outside the womb. It is the moment of conception, where the human comes together as the image bearer, respected from that moment. A sinner, yes, but a human being made in God's image. At that moment, you began to knit me together. Yes, Psalm 127 says, children are a heritage from the Lord. Birth is a wonderful moment, but conception is a divine moment. Now, when we were at Ashfield, our church secretary was an agricultural scientist, and when we had announcements of birth in the congregation, he gave them like an agricultural scientist would. He got up and said, mum and baby are well, and this is about the weight, that's about it. And then when he was replaced and stepped down, retired from being the church secretary, he was replaced by an obstetrician. Man, oh man, when he announced a birth, you got every intimate detail. You felt like saying, I don't want to know all this stuff, but he would give you all forceps or not, or, you know, all this sort of business. It was gory stuff. But isn't it remarkable? Look at this again. Look at verse 13. He says, you knit me together in my mother's womb. I'm fearfully, wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in a secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Remarkable that David has such insight. 96,000 times a day. Just think of that. Your heart beats 96,000 times a day. The pump goes. The brightest light your eye can see, 400 times brighter than the dimmest light that your eye can see. Your joints wonderfully sponged in cartilage. 1,600 kilometres of blood vessels bringing about your efficient movement. And no two of us are the same. We're fearfully made. God led nothing to fate, nothing to chance. You ordain my life's length, even before my birth. No wonder the hymnist says, we are lost in wonder, love and praise. My thoughts are lost in his immensity. My pride is drowned in his infinity. It's a wonderful psalm, isn't it? It's a breathtakingly wonderful psalm. And how good to have that announcement this morning, that we're praying once a month, as from next Monday at 1:30, for this whole issue of the preservation and the respect of life from the moment of conception. Well, I reckon this is a great psalm. For 4 years I was the chaplain at the Pittwood Nursing Home, and when I visited elderly people there, I would often ask them, what is your favourite psalm? And I'd read that. And I think in the top 10, Psalm 139 would always come. Number one was always Psalm 23. Psalm 100, because it was a Presbyterian nursing home, came pretty closely, number two. But Psalm 139 was there as well. But imagine this. I can imagine this, because it was always a bit embarrassing. Oh, Mr. Cook, would you read Psalm 139? But don't worry about that last part. I don't particularly like that, all about that slaying and hating and loathing. Just leave out verses 19 to 24. Is that all right? Just read 1 to 18. And that was fine by me. I didn't want to have to explain the embarrassment of verses 19 to 24. But look at verses 19 to 24. This is the whole direction of the psalm. This is where the psalmist is headed. This is the so what factor. This is the application. We have an omni-God. He knows all. He is ever present. He is all powerful. He will have an omni-righteous people who are in solidarity with him and not in solidarity with the wicked. And you may well come to verses 19 to 24 as I do, and you're embarrassed by such strong language, slaying the wicked, hating those who hate you, loathing those who rise up against you. But my embarrassment may be a dangerous sign of my apathy and double-mindedness in my relationship with God, as the blood of the innocents is shed, verse 19. Those who've been intricately woven in the womb and made in God's image, discarded, an inconvenience. God's name is a favourite term of abuse. The ignoring of the omni-God as a natural way of life, the God who knows, the God who is present, the God who is all-powerful. And we can just shrug our shoulders. Well, it doesn't affect us. Everybody's got a right and freedom to do their own thing. One man's meat is another man's poison. And this psalm asks you a fundamental question. Where is your address? With whom do you identify? Where do you walk, stand, or sit? In a day when the political parties, Labour and Liberal, are both battling for the middle ground. No extremes. In a day where the wise person sits on the fence, the wise person is the balanced person, sees everything relatively. Jeffrey Robertson in Hypotheticals, there's a nuclear ship from the United States Navy coming into harbour in Sydney Harbour and berthing at Garden Island. What do you do? Well, one person said, I go out and I protest against the presence of this nuclear weaponry. Jeffrey Robinson said, but what if one of your friends says, well, let's go down to Lady Macquarie's chair opposite the ship, and I've got some automatic weapons, and let's see how many American sailors we can pick off the decks. Would you do that? Oh, no, I wouldn't do that. That's not my thing. But if they want to do that, let them do that, but that's not my thing. It's relative, isn't it? Is it your thing? You go and kill. But no, I wouldn't do it. A day in which objective standards of right and wrong are disappearing. See, this psalm leaves us with this tremendous question. With whom do you identify? Verse 19, with the bloodthirsty? Who have no respect for the sanctity of life? Verse 20, with those who with evil intent speak against God, who made them wonderfully? Verse 21, do you identify with the arrogant rebels? Where do you walk? Where do you stand? Where do you sit? Look, the psalmist is clear, isn't he? Look at 21. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And abhor those who rise up against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them as my enemies. He's got such grief that there is such wickedness in the light of what the omni-God has done for us. But notice, he knows his own heart. Because when he starts talking about hatred and loathing, he's tempted to take things into his own hand and to seek revenge. And he knows that the righteous God will have a righteous people who are zealous for good deeds. That the human judge of others must himself be judged. That he must not develop a sense of superiority. He brings himself under the scrutiny of God, the searching, discerning God who is acquainted with all his ways. Verse 1, you have searched me. And verse 23, search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. Search me afresh. I don't trust myself. When I'm emotional, when I'm passionate, I tend to lose touch with reality. Search me. Winnow me. Investigate me, test me, and lead me in the everlasting way. What are the enemies of the Lord Jesus criticise him for? For eating with tax collectors and sinners, wicked people. But he never joined them in order to identify with them and take their cause on him as his own. He joined them in a redemptive way, that they might come into his kingdom. And so the question is, do you stand with the omni-righteous God? You may feel very much at home preaching verses 1 to 18, but they're just the lead up to verses 19 to 24. Where do you stand? With whom do you show solidarity? With whom do you identify? It is so much more difficult, isn't it? Because it is the scandal of Christianity that it allows no escape from the real world, and we need to make tough choices. Your child comes home from school. You notice that as you unpack the school bag, all of a sudden there is a pack of 24 Texticolors there, which you didn't give the child. They didn't have pocket money to buy it. Where did they get it from? No questions asked. Zip it up and that's all right. After all, possession is 9/10 of the law. Well, that tax return, oh, you can fudge a bit there. They allow you to fudge up to $250 at that point. Knock that off your taxable income. Oh, yes, add that claim in there. They allow that anyway. Just fudge a bit. Oh, I've got this great material in my essay. Oh, I can use that material. It is terrific material. And I don't have to source it. After all, no one will know. The omni-God will have an omni-righteous people. Well, do you really believe that Jesus is the only way to heaven? Do you really believe that there's a place of everlasting destruction and all the Hindus and people like that are there and it's only you Christians who come to Jesus who will escape being there? Do you really believe that? Are you so heavenly minded that you won't even come to this movie with me because of your so-called standards? Look, everybody is doing it. Why don't you come and join in too? That's hard. By your call of mercy, by your grace divine, we are on the Lord's side. Saviour, we are thine. Young man with his wife and little daughter coming down the street. They come to a roadblock. A fine man there, a centurion. Stop. You just have to offer some incense to Caesar's image and say Caesar is Lord. No. For me and my household, Jesus is Lord. Look, young man, you look like a fine young man. You've got a lovely wife. You've got a lovely, healthy little girl. All you have, Jesus is Lord, that's fine. That's terrific. All I'm asking you, just pick up some incense, drop it in the flames there, and just say, Caesar, Lord, and you'll be on your way. No problems at all. No one will worry. For me and my house, Jesus is Lord. Take him away. Take him away. It's not easy. First century, 21st century. There was a man in the second century, you've probably heard of him. He was called Much Fruit. Sprinkled some incense. We've got nothing against you, you're just an old man. Just say Caesar is Lord. And Much Fruit, Polycarp, said, for 86 years have I served him and he's done me no wrong. How then can I blaspheme my king who saved me? To the flames. Much fruit. We are those who have met the omni-God. Our thoughts are lost in his immensity. Our pride, my pride, is drowned in his infinity. We are privileged to make our address with him. Blessed are those who don't walk in the counsel of the wicked, or stand in the way of sinners, or sit in the seat of mockers. Search us, O God, and know our hearts. Test us and know our anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in any of us, and lead us in the way everlasting.